Welcome to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
This week on the podcast, you're in for a real treat. We're joined by Dr. Hans Rosling, who's in town for the University of Minnesota's Institute on the Environment's Momentum 2011 event. Dr. Rosling is professor of global health at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden, but you might know him best from his many engaging and enlightening TED Talks. And if you don't, well, you should. He presents global health and population statistics in stunning and entertaining fashion in such talks as Let My Data Set Change Your Mindset and The Magic Washing Machine. So don't go away, because Dr. Rosling and I talk about why data is sexy, what it would mean to live with a fact-based worldview, and what it's like to be a Swede visiting Minnesota. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by Dr. Hans Rosling, who is professor of international health at Karolinska Institute in Sweden. He's co-founder and chairman of the Gapminder Foundation, and many of you listening will probably know him from his very lively and engaging TED Talks, where he presents fantastic visualizations of data that are always interesting and entertaining. So welcome, Dr. Rosling.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to start off with a question. I've actually been following your Twitter feed, and last week you had a tweet in response to CNN. They had posted something about how visualizing data is just really meant to make data look sexy, and your response was, CNN's gotten it all wrong, that data is sexy. And so I thought I'd just start with that, because I think, you know, some people might find that to be sort of a strange assertion, that, you know, something is kind of geeky as data can be that, you know, interesting or attractive. So I wonder if you just explain what it is about data that you think is...
Well, the way in American English that you use sexy is sort of very wide. I was thinking more about the core meaning of the word sexy. And I never thought that it was the lipstick that was sexy. I think it was my wife. So it is the content, it's what's really there, which is interesting. If you can make my son and his wife, who are really the creators of the software we have at Gapminder and who are doing the design, they used to say you can never put lipstick on a pig. It has to be a good content, and all big chefs say that, you know, if you're going to make good food, you need to have good raw material. And it's a little like this. We in the beginning in Gapminder, we say we had a motto, you know, a mission statement, which said that we convert boring statistics to enjoyable graphics. But after a year or two, we realized how stupid it was. And then we changed it to say we unveil the beauty of statistics. If you have a composition, you have a piece of Mozart, you know, is the beauty in the composition, is the beauty already in the notes, or is the beauty only being added when it's played? No, it's already there in the composition. I've seen that film about Mozart when Salieri, the other composer who no one knows anything about, when he was mad in the end, you know, and he was in the mental hospital, you know, and that man who took care of him, you know, he hadn't heard any of Salieri's composition. And then Salieri said, da-da-da-da, oh, that one I know, he said, you know. The beauty is in that, da-da-da-da, you know, yes, that is a beauty, you know. So this is what I wanted to say. Things which are really interesting, things which are beautiful, you know, what we perceive sexually as sexy, it's not the lipstick, it's not what you put on top of it. It is the ability of putting something on top of it. It's the ability of playing Mozart that's revealed the beauty which is already there. And it is pretty beauty to have numbers on how human societies have emerged, has developed, you know, and how schooling has... It's very amazing. But it's like a composition of Mozart. Very, very few people can look at those musical notes and say, oh, this is beautiful music. That's one out of 10,000. Mm-hmm. The rest of us, the crowd, we need someone to play it to us.
Right.
And that's what I think we are doing when we are animating and visualizing statistics. We are enabling many people to see the beauty and the enormous interest in, which is in the numbers already from the start.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is it seems like, you know, your average person who maybe doesn't know much about statistics or might be a little bit intimidated to be able to see it in a presentation, like what you're able to put together, which I just heard you talking about how many hours and hours go into preparing that, but that makes it more consumable, but people might get caught up in how beautiful the presentation is and not really realize that the information that's there is what's really beautiful.
My son said that when you make something beautiful, you show that it's important to you.
Mm. Huh?
If you go for a date, you spend some time with your hair. Huh? Mm. You spend some time with how you dress.
Right. Huh?
But the person you are dating, you don't want them to get interest in that dress and that hair, though you like them commenting the hair and the dress, but
right.
They want you to be interested in the person below the hair and behind the dress.
Right.
So enhancing the beauty on the superior, you know, is just making us able to see what is behind. And this is what is needed with number. Because those of us, and I'm one of them, who have been consuming numbers in great amounts, the beauty appears in my head.
Hmm.
I can consume. I used to get every year the State of the World's Children from UNICEF, the yearbook, and it had 12 tables in the end with data.
Hmm.
And this came around 15th of December every year, you know. And I would get it at the workplace, and then I would bring it at home, you know. And I would read it in bed.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife would say, I accept that you read in bed. I also accept that you read statistics in bed. But I don't accept that you make those noises, when you read statistics in bed. You have to be quiet.
Wow.
So that was before we started this Gapminder project. Because, you know, if you're interested, you know, I remember this was like the fall of child mortality in Malaysia. I was following that in the 90s, you know, how fantastic it was, how countries could go from very high child mortality rate to very low, how fast kids could be able to go to school in some countries, you know, when economic growth was there, policy was the right one, you know, there was support for. And I saw that year by year, and then I would go, wow, oh. You know, and sort of the images appeared in my head. So I've said that what we have been doing at Gapminder, what my son and his wife and the team around them has been able to do, is an MR, a magnetic resonance tomography of the head of an analyst.
Mm-hmm.
He has to bring out the beauty which is inside. So instead of having to go through all these courses and statistics, you know, having to read all these tables, you know, you can present it in front of the eyes and then many can see it.
Hmm.
It's a little like a map, you know.
Yeah.
Someone can learn their way around, you know.
Right.
We are in Sweden very impressed by the Samic people who herd their reindeers up in the mountains, and they just know their way.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've been walking through the same mountains since they were young, you know, and they've got to know them. They don't need maps, you know. But it's a very efficient way when you are a newcomer to that mountain, you know, and you go trekking to have a map.
Mm-hmm.
And if the map is sort of beautiful and clear, you know, it makes it easier for you to see it. And geography has come very far in making good maps. So what we are doing actually is that we are adding map concept to statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when Google acquired, because the software developed, the software itself was called Trendalyzer, developed in Gapminder Foundation, was acquired by Google in 2007, and is now freely available as a gadget called Motion Chart, and filled with data called Google Public Data, where anyone who has data can make it available freely through this technology provided free by Google. Basically the same as Google Earth. But it's much, much more difficult to provide statistical data in the same way as geography data. And the reason is simple. All geographical data can be described as longitude and latitude. Sometimes in the Rocky Mountains you need altitude.
Okay.
There is longitude, latitude, and altitude, and that is a descriptor for every piece of information. In statistics, we stratify society and nature into infinity. Populations falls into males and females, immigrants and born in the country. A very interesting topic, it seems, these days in the United States, where you were born. And then what weight you had when you were born. Whether you were born with disease or you were healthy, whether you acquired disease, whether you are disabled, what education you went through, if you are employed, if you are unemployed, what sport organization. Human populations are hopeless.
Yeah.
They are not satisfied with longitude, latitude, and altitude. And then you add environmental data to this.
Mm-hmm.
Now administrative areas doesn't correspond to environmental areas. Mm-hmm. A river flows through several states.
Right.
And if it's polluted in one state, that's going to be a reality in another state. So you need other areas of the data.
Mm-hmm.
And you have factories that emit. So making data available is a long-term process,
yeah,
which the new information technology has made us able to advance on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it will take a long time until we build the literacy. And what we want, you know, is that anyone can just go onto their computer and ask, let me see the U.S. budget.
Mm-hmm.
How has it changed? When did this budget deficit occur? Is it too much spending or is it a tax cut? Haha, it's both. How, what important is it of that? What about this trade to China? What about this price of oil? And then have a heated political debate, but based on the data.
Right, and that leads me to my next question, which is, you know, on the Gapminder website, you have your mission there that it's a fact tank, and it's about promoting a fact-based worldview, which seems like what you were just bridging into. So can you talk a little bit about how you envision that? Like, what is a fact-based worldview as opposed to what's happening, you know, right now and how this...
But the first I used to say is that you can never, ever understand the world only with numbers.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work. There are so many other values, you know, and realities of people's faith and values and human rights that can never be catched in numbers.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you can never understand the world without numbers, because then you are lost. You don't know the proportions, the speed of change. Numbers is like a skeleton of understanding the world. Yeah? And then you need a lot of other things. So we have focused on the skeleton, on the anatomy of the skeleton. And then the numbers, there are two types of numbers. One which are pretty solid. They are mature indicators. GDP per capita has its weaknesses, but it has been collected in a systematic way which makes it comparable over time and between countries. Number of children per woman, the same thing, and so on. Those are the things. So we say that what is not numbers, we cannot present. The numbers which are very doubtful, we take out.
Okay.
And then we take the solid numbers. However, we have tried to make historical gap filling to make understanding, to be able to compare all countries. And then we have compiled some time series. And then we defend ourselves. We said, at the museum, if you display a skeleton of a dinosaur and one hind leg is missing, what do you do? Well, if you are correct, you display the skeleton with three legs, and all children will come back and say, oh, mother, the dinosaur had only three legs. So you can't do that. You have to put the plastic leg on.
Right.
So the child came home, oh, it was a beautiful skeleton of a dinosaur. The child won't know that it's a plastic leg, but you don't fake it. And you put the little note there, and you said, this hind leg was lost when a river changed its course 10,000 years ago. And we have replaced it with a plastic ones. So you don't. This is our principle, the museum principle of displaying dinosaur skeletons. You know, so in the and why can we do this? Because people are missing numbers. When it comes to the world, you always ask people, are you a pessimist or are you an optimist? Mm-hmm. You don't ask them, are you knowledgeable or are you ignorant?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we think that too often I'm said that I'm an optimist. I just happen to be knowledgeable. Uh-huh. I know that the educational level is high in the Islamic Republic of Iran, you know. I know that child mortality has fallen, and I know that the number of children per woman in Iran is lower than in Sweden. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that I like the president of Iran.
Right.
That doesn't mean that I've taken have another relation to the religion in Iran. I just know those facts. I happen to know the person who collected the data also, you know, and I know that it's done according to international standards. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that I'm pessimistic, optimistic, or have a political view. It's a bloody fact of Iran that it's a fairly advanced country when it comes to these social factors, you know, in the country. And this we have seen when we have studied across the Swedish society and the world, that the knowledge about the change in the world is surprisingly low. Mm-hmm. Surprisingly low. For instance, the number of children born per year in the world hasn't increased the last 20 years. Hmm. There's 135 million children born every year for 20 years. And people think, oh, the population is growing because, you know, they're having too many children in those Muslim countries and the poor countries, and if we give aid, it will just get worse.
Right.
And that's not an ethical problem with that. It's just that they are so ignorant. It's unbelievable ignorance. So that's why we've seen a business opportunity, as you would say in the US. We've seen a business opportunity, you know. But we've found that to provide this information, to be strategically non-profit, was good. We are a foundation, like a museum, mm-hmm. a foundation. We are free from the government, we are free from the corporate sector, we are free from the university. And what we provide is free teaching material. And you can find that at gapminder.org. We owe the name to London Underground.
Right.
They warn everyone, mind the gap between the train and the platform. You know? And we thought it was a good idea to mind gaps. So,
So you talk about, too, that there are kind of these devastating myths out there. And you touched on just a few, some of the things that a lot of us are very ignorant about in the world. So what would you say are kind of maybe the top two or three myths that you think the general
number one
should know?
If you save the poor children, you destroy the planet. Is the number one myth, because that's the what most often Bill and Melinda Gates hears when they have focused their generous donation to improving health of the poorest children. And that's a sort of a myth. You don't hear it in seminar rooms in universities officially, but down at the Starbucks, you know, and at the bar and so on, that's what you hear, you know? That's the number one myth we have. The other is that the world population is just growing and growing. Mm-hmm. That's a very big myth. A third myth is sort of related to the energy. And it's not a myth, but it's misunderstanding that the renewable energy is still absolutely insignificant. It's absolutely insignificant. And especially in Europe, we get carried away by seeing new windmills, and we are seeing, you know, some solar energy, you know, though we put import tariff on Chinese solar panels, which is absolutely embarrassing. Yeah. Absolutely embarrassing. So it's an impression that we move towards more renewable energy. Mm-hmm. But we haven't done nothing yet. That's my conclusion. We haven't done that. It's a completely fossil fuel run world, which Donald Trump said this morning, you know. He said in TV that those people in OPEC shouldn't raise the oil price because they are there only because of us. Mm-hmm. It was a very blunt and clear statement that the regime in Saudi Arabia, with the lowest democracy score in the world given by a U.S. university, lower than North Korea, is there only because of the U.S. administration. It was admitted on TV by Donald Trump today.
Wow.
And that is a myth. Another myth is that West Europe and North America is working for democracy in Middle East. That's a myth. Mm-hmm. All intellectuals in Middle East see that that hasn't happened. Mm. Mubarak has been sitting in the knee of the NATO and the Western countries.
Right.
It was the people who had to alert us, you know, that this is not democracy. And so I could pick a number of myths like that.
Yeah. So how do you hope that kind of this fact-based worldview that you're proposing can kind of cut through some of these myths? I mean, how do you see that or hope that that will happen?
It's already happening. Hmm. But my surprise is very big to see where it's happening.
Hmm.
And I'm almost embarrassed to see who are the ones who pick it up first. It's the CEOs of the biggest international companies.
Really?
They are fact-based.
Hmm.
They are fact-based. Talk to the CEO of Pfizer, Noviartis, Shell, Microsoft. They know. They are out there.
Hmm.
They know what the facts are. They are not racists.
Right. Yeah?
They, CEOs of major companies, they have employees, they have customers, and they have owners.
Mm-hmm.
Not the financial sector. The financial sector, they're emotional. Impossible to understand, yeah?
Yeah.
But the CEOs of the major companies, they see this shift,
huh.
And they understand what it means for their business. They see it's time to go to Africa now. It's time to move major parts of our activity to Asia, you know, and they follow it. And to me, like a public health professor from Sweden, that's almost a painful realization.
Right.
And it doesn't come easy. Doesn't come easy, you know. But I have come to that conclusion. Whereas the public and the academia is very slow to realize the world.
Hmm.
That's very embarrassing. I did this test at Karolinska Institute of the professors who hand out the Nobel Prize in medicine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they scored worse than the... they were on par with the chimpanzee. But all the, they didn't know, I asked them, whether child mortality in Asian countries to European countries. And we haven't realized the speed of change. Very few are aware that child mortality has fallen in Bangladesh faster than it ever did in Sweden.
Hmm.
The fall per year. The fall of child mortality in Brazil the last 15 years of child mortality has been twice the speed of fall mortality in child mortality in Sweden the last century.
Hmm.
There is a catch-up taking place, and there is no mental preparation for that. Even the environmental students in Sweden, they keep telling me another myth they said. All Chinese cannot have a car. Over and over again, the last 20 years I've heard that. All Chinese cannot have a car. With that, it doesn't mean that 100% of the Chinese should have a car, but they mean the Chinese cannot have car to the same ways we have in Sweden.
Mm.
I think they heard it in China, and that's why they bought the Volvo company. Because the Chinese intellectual people, I say, how the heck could you have more cars than we? What do you mean?
Right.
The colonial time is over. Mm. Wake up.
Mm-hmm.
Eh? If you say all Chinese cannot have a car, you must say that all people in the world cannot have a car.
Right.
But that's not said. In the Institute of Environment, it's not said. Because it's still that concept where the CEO of the major company are much more fact-based than the students of environment.
Hmm. Wow. Very disheartening in a way, I guess.
Yeah, it's scary. And go to the environmental students of Stockholm and I say, sometimes you have to use DDT. And they say, no! We shouldn't use DDT. No, I don't say that you should use DDT to solve the malaria problem in the world. That was an illusion. Because the ecological impact of that is impossible. But if you have a refugee camp in Africa,
mm-hmm.
where you have severe flooding during rains, and you get an outburst of malaria transmission, you have to use selectively DDT during 1 to 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
No, they said you should never use DDT. Mm-hmm. Nature is big. Allah Akbar. It's almost a religious view on the environment for some, especially the young new students. You know, they have a vision, you know, that you can protect the environment totally. And I say, we shouldn't have antibiotics in the feeds to the animals. That's a terrible way of using. But when the animal is sick and when a human has a meningitis, we treat with antibiotics.
Right.
And we shouldn't put DDT as a general solution in the environment. But when you have a terrible public health situation, you use it. And that's to have that understanding of the world, you know, it's we still want to look at one solution at a time.
Mm-hmm.
You're concerned about the environment, you're concerned about human rights, you're concerned about health, you are concerned about your religion, you know, you take one at a time. We need a world where we protect the environment, you know, we have the human rights, we have decent living standards for everyone, you know, we have possibility to do school. We have to think about several good things at the same time.
Right. So, I heard you a minute ago in the class that you were talking about kind of what all goes into your TED Talks, and I thought our listeners might be a little bit interested in hearing that. So, it's a big production. Can you just describe a little bit of what all goes into your process for preparing a big presentation like that?
Well, first you put in 30 years of research in the area.
That's number one,
you know, and 30 years of reading,
right.
Or even more, 40. And then you put in a life experience of working in other countries. I've had the privilege to work with African colleagues, Asian colleagues, Middle East, Latin America, you know, and to live short periods, but still in other countries. And that adds enormously to it. Then you identify a topic. Then we go look for the data.
Mm-hmm.
Then we see what are the visualization tools we have. To what extent will we use them? To what extent would we need to do more handicraft too? At that point, then, you say, what should the story be about?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to decide what the content should be. And you see what you can produce with the software you have and what you have to rewrite new, either in Flash, HTML5, or in Keynote, which is flexible, or in PowerPoint for that case.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start working, and the team will consist with one who would focus on the content, one who would assist getting the updated data, that's the content part. Mm-hmm. Then it would be the design part, who would think about how you make that visual, you know. First, how to make it understandable, then how to make it beautiful. And then the tech part, which would write the code so it happens on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you iterate. And in the center of that is the rhetoric story you will use.
Right.
And in doing this, you know, to reach a good level of it, it takes some people some months to do it.
Yeah.
So it's really costly. And then in the end, you write the storyboard and you rehearse it. And during the last 48 hours, you rehearse it 20 times. And my principle is that the good lecture is very well prepared. The bad lecture follow very well the preparation. So you have to adapt and you have to change in that.
Right.
But the TED team has also been absolutely magnificent. You know, they convinced me to talk at TED. I said no first. You know. They convinced me to upload these videos. Joan Cohen and Jason Wishnow. Who are the producers of this, you know, they have a skill, they've developed actually a new media format, which is the pre and post produced public lectures, because they enter into your lecture before you are there, and they help you to scale it down and to get the right size, and they discuss the content, they help you on stage and direct you before and after, and then they do this wonderful post-production, which you don't think. You think this is just a video shot there.
Yeah.
It's 3-4 camera. They hire cameramen that understand the topics and that are interesting. They know how to zoom in when you make your punchline, you know.
Wow.
And then they cut them afterwards. They record your image
mm-hmm.
through animation. They zoom in that afterwards.
Yeah.
they do in an amazingly short time, very efficiently, you know. And Chris Anderson has kept this team growing, you know, in a remarkable way. They moved from being a conference that had a web page to be a web page that used a conference to produce the web page material. So I have benefited a lot from that process. I owe a lot of this success to firstly to my son, his wife, and the team I've developed the software, and second to the team at TED, who had know how to take short talks with animations out to videos.
And you know, you talk about those three different parts of the process: the content, the design, and the technical part. And you, it seems to me, at any point in that iterative process, there can be big hang-ups or, you know, things that aren't quite working together right. And you do all this with family members, your son and your daughter-in-law. So
no, but also the team at Gapminder.
And the team at Gapminder. But with having family involved, I'm just curious, is that, you know, how does that work for family relations? And is it easy for you guys, or is it...
Had it been difficult, we wouldn't have continued. And my son said it was because you were the first man who let me rent a Nintendo on the street. He said, I always play computer game with the kids. I never found there was any contrast by being serious in your professional life and your content and having fun. I would go to circus, you know, I'm a sword swallower, you know, I play computer games, you know, I see no contradiction between playing computer game and liking poetry.
Right.
But it may be a social class identification. I'm a Swedish redneck.
Swedish redneck. So speaking of being Swedish, and I know you have to get onto another thing here, but, you know, in Minnesota, some of us are pretty, you know, proud of our Scandinavian heritage. And I'm just wondering, being a visitor from Sweden to Minnesota, do you feel that?
We are pretty proud of Minnesota.
I can tell you more about that.
The best novel in the Swedish language is Vilhelm Moberg's The Immigrators, and the Settlers. You know, that is the novel in the Swedish language.
Really?
And the story about the poorest people in Sweden who had no chance in life, when health got better, family grew, there was no more land, urbanization didn't take off, Sweden was not early in industrialization, and that this opportunity opened itself to emigrate. And that country became so well organized and was so much richer, so money was being sent back home. Mm-hmm. And we're helping those who stayed back to improve their life, you know. Mm-hmm. And they got stimulations back, you know, that you doesn't have to be a count, doesn't have to be an ability. Normal people can make it, you know. Yeah. That spirit fed itself back to Sweden also. So it has been a very, very good interlink, I think, because it has been peaceful. There's been some critical moments also of it, but Sweden has benefited a lot from Minnesota.
Wow. Yeah?
And it's interesting, when you go to Gapminder, pick time on the horizontal axis, GDP per capita on the vertical axis, and pick US and Sweden, and then you can see the difference in income. And you see the huge difference in income, immigration goes there. And then it's whether there's no more difference in income, there's no immigration. It's very interesting to see how driving, we say people went here for a religious freedom. That's right. Lots of my ancestors came for that very reason. But they left the Swedish church to the free church because they were so poor. And they didn't like the way the church was just helping the rich, you know. So it was also socioeconomic rebellion, the free church movement. And so in the end, you know, you can really see the economic relations between the countries. But then you can also see the enormous difference that has emerged. Mm. How Sweden has become very secular today.
Right.
And the bishop in the Church of Sweden in Stockholm, she lives in a lesbian relationship with a 3-year-old son, and she's the bishop of the Church of Sweden in Stockholm. And that's yet to happen in the United States.
Yeah, yeah? We're a little ways off.
The Christian Democrat Party in Sweden, which you would call the Christian right, they are pro-abortion. Everyone is pro-abortion. It's a non-issue in Sweden. Because we have been assessing what it would need not to have free abortion, you get illegal abortion, or you get other aspects, you know. And though we have concerns about it, we have come to the conclusion this is how it should be. So the Swedish society is much more coherent today than we see America. We have difficulty understanding the disparities in America, you know. And there we are, yes, we are sort of, we've been very lucky in history, very, very lucky in history in Sweden. And part of that was that 25% of the population had a chance to leave the country when there was no opportunities in Sweden. And leaving the country also benefited back. They sent the benefit back. And that's the reason why I'm here in Minneapolis. We still have links, and I found so many people who speak Swedish here.
Exactly.
And we continued to travel back and forth. And I saw it the first morning from the hotel room. I looked at the weather. It was pouring down, raining, and I realized this is why the Swedes felt at home here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all for Office Hours this week, but we've got a great set of interviews here in the queue coming your way soon, so if you've not subscribed to our feed in your podcast client of choice, please go do that now. And if you're liking what we do here on Office Hours and at the Society Pages, head over to iTunes and give us a rating or write a review. That'll help other people find our podcast, and we'd really appreciate it. Thanks to the rest of the TSP team and CLA OIT at the University of Minnesota for hosting this MP3 or MPEG 2 Audio Layer 3 file for us. See you all soon.
But I don't accept that you make those noises.
When you read statistics in bed, you have to be quiet.